I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. American Psychological Association report from 2016 finds most people who receive psychotherapy experience symptom relief and are better able to function in their lives. About 75% show some benefit. Today, we discuss types of psychotherapy and talk a little bit about the evolution of our brains with psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychologist Michael Abbruzzese. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
So psychotherapy or talk therapy, right? So I guess, what is it and who's a candidate?
Talk therapy is a type of so-called psychotherapy. When people talk about psychotherapy, maybe Mark has a different take on this, but it's really a very broad brush they're painting with different kinds of things. And, you know, for example, you mentioned the American Psychological Association. Mark has the American Psychiatric Association with different divisions or specialties. And last count, there's about 50 different kind of subspecialties in the American Psychological Association applying psychology to different things. And many of those things are different types of psychotherapy. So you talk about psychotherapy, it doesn't really explain very much other than the fact it's a kind of therapy different from physical therapy or occupational therapy, but it's a lot more nuanced than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but what it has in common, though, is that it occurs in a social setting, people interacting. And whatever the technique is, actually, in my reading, I found that there were 1,000 different types of psychotherapy.
Oh, my goodness. That's 1,000.
Surprise
wow.
me.
Yeah.
When I was in training, there were 400. So things have improved.
Yeah.
It basically is a social interaction. And it, as we get into it, it...
I would say it's probably an ameliorative or changing, you know, evolving kind of interaction. If it just stays static, then it's not really therapeutic. So...
Right.
Talking to your friends, talking to the local bartender, that is very therapeutic, but it's not therapy. Therapy is a change agent, you know, like surgery.
Mm-hmm.
You go to surgery to change something, not to make things the same. Exactly. So there's also a difference between therapeutic and therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
And so would then psychotherapy include medications?
It certainly can, absolutely. There's a strong social component or interaction component, relationship component to prescribing medication. It's really critical. You can't just dispense a pill and expect a change. Sometimes there is some change, but a lot of times people don't accept it unless there's some trust built up, unless there's some belief and safety in the relationship. That's really key, that there be a safe setting where an interaction can take place. And that doesn't take place between friends, really. Psychotherapy is really a very unique relationship where all the attention is on the person coming in. And if it's not, then you don't have a good psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. But it has to be all focused on the attention. The only time in life where we have such a relationship, hopefully, is early infancy. The mother is, or the caretaker, is totally focused on the child. After that is over, you don't experience that again, except for aspects of psychotherapy. Do repeat it.
Well, just to follow up what Mark said, it's in the old days, folks, you know, our generation or early generation might talk about a doctor's bedside manner.
Yeah.
It's really talk about the quality of the relationship that Mark's talking about. And one of the criticisms of people who prescribe medications in a 5 or 6 minute office visit, they really don't pay much attention to the individual. Right. And that was the same kind of criticism lodged against behavioral psychologists at the beginning of using behavioral psychology, that you didn't care about the person, just did the mechanical kind of application with no bedside manner. And, you know, and people walked away very unsatisfied. So the hallmark of a therapeutic relationship is the relationship being able to affect positive change to the person. So it's worked whether you're prescribing meds or just doing therapy or talk therapy or supportive therapy. That really is like the hallmark. You need that kind of healing or restorative relationship. Otherwise, I couldn't call it therapy.
And that doesn't just exist in psychology or psychiatry. It exists in general medicine.
Right.
When you hear people say they're going to get some surgery, what they base their choice of surgeon on is, I think, 90% the interaction they've had with the surgeon.
Right.
Also, 10% may be what they've been told about the surgery or surgeon. But a large component of their comfort in going under the knife might be the 10 minutes that they spend with the surgeon and get a feel for him as a person.
We all know surgeons are so warm and fuzzy.
I was just going to say, I actually had a surgeon many years ago who was very cold, a terrible bedside manner, but he was a fabulous surgeon, and I went on that.
That's a logical choice.
Right.
But we're still guided by the feel.
So you're mentioning 1,000 different specialties here. And so who's a candidate for this, and how do you know which psychotherapy you need?
I think everyone's a candidate for therapy. Yeah. And I, you know, maybe Mark agrees with me. I think everyone should see a qualified psychological professional, psychiatrist, social worker, psychologist, someone who's very skilled, just to check in. You know, I think a lot of people are afraid of doing that because of some of the mythology, the mm-hmm. things they've seen on movies and TVs about what psychotherapy is. And mostly it's the kind of stuff that, you know, Woody Allen movies were kind of funny for the weird kind of therapy that he was in and stuff. And I think in recent events you may argue was not all that successful for him. Mm-hmm. But that's, I think, mostly psychodynamically oriented, a psychoanalytically oriented psychodynamic psychotherapy, which is much different from a lot of the proven technologies and therapy that are done now. So everyone should check in. They really shouldn't fear any kind of therapeutic contact with a qualified therapist. But I think Mark would agree with this. There's a lot of variability in the field about the quality of, mm-hmm. you know, doctoring, psychologing, thing that you get depending on who you see and the training they've had. So you can't always be sure you're going to get a great healer.
Right. Well, what brings people to therapy is some kind of difficulty in their life, usually around a behavior that they have that is causing problems, gambling, whatever, addictions of some sort, or a relationship problem. And then also basic symptoms that they're having, panic attacks, depression where they're not functioning like they used to, can't concentrate. And if they have a stream of internal dialogue that is always negative, basically mm-hmm. depression. So those are the things that will bring people in. But you're right, anybody could profit from it because it's a learning experience.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's a learning experience that's really very unique. You can't get it out of a book.
Mm-hmm.
You might be able to get aspects of it out of journaling, writing, mm-hmm. And reviewing what you write. Otherwise, it's... it is learning.
And you could be surprised by the, I'm going to share a personal experience. I went to a psychiatrist once, and it was because I woke up all the time, and I kept, I make little dashes on a notepad next to the bed, be like 18 times, 20 times. So I thought, my mother had depression. Could it be? I don't know if it's, so I go to the psychiatrist. I got 15 minutes, by the way, because he said, see a sleep doctor. And that's exactly, it was a sleep disorder, but yeah. I was like, oh, a sleep doctor. I was like 15 minutes, but I still had to pay for the hour. Yeah, you're fine. Go see. But yeah, so you never know what you're going to find out. And that is something I never would have dawned on me. I'm not mm-hmm. sleeping, but would you think of sleep?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
You might go in to a therapy office thinking you might have something, and it's really something else.
Yeah.
Sometimes
right.
you go to a physician and you think it's something, and it's not that, or something, much sure. different.
That was a sharp doctor, right?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. All right, so let's talk a little bit about how our brains have evolved.
Sure.
Allegedly evolved.
Allegedly evolved. They have evolved, haven't they?
Yes, that's true. Yes.
Well, first off, humans appeared on the Earth probably about 100,000 years ago. But language and communication and the social interaction and cooperation goes back to only 50,000 years ago. So we're talking about something that has evolved, say, with the human brain over 100,000 years or so. And it has evolved with one purpose in mind. Everything that's been added to the brain is added because it has a survival value. Things aren't added because it improves the accuracy of perception. It's survival. Just in general, that sets us up for a lot of distortions because what is good for survival might not be good for accuracy. But the mechanics of what has evolved is, the best way to approach it, I think, is to think of two systems of processing information, a fast system and a slow system. All animals, say before, let's say 100,000 years ago and before that, had really just a fast system. In other words, they would adapt to the environment in a way that any kind of stimulus that indicated threat to their survival was met with a behavioral response. Think of the reptiles. They respond real quickly to threat, and they don't have too much of a repertoire of behavior. They have running away, attacking, playing dead, more or less. But they still have this mechanism to respond, especially the threat, because obviously threat is going to affect survival. Well, the human brain still has that brain at the center. And what it makes us human is what is built on top of it. But what is built on top doesn't do away with what is central and what is basic. So that means that all of our information about the environment is first filtered through this FAST system and is characterized and identified and perceived unconsciously before it gets to the slow system. The slow system is the conscious processing. And there's a difference in timing. The FAST system processes and information in a half second. And there's behavior or reaction based on that processing of a half second. And the information that that FAST system pulls together is all about safety and earlier experiences of safety. Then the information goes to the slow system, which processes it a half second later. And then we're aware, consciously aware, of what the stimulus is in the environment. So we actually live a half second behind, or actually a second behind reality. Reality first gets into the brain in a half second, but the reactivity is already characterized at that half second before it's presented to the conscious part of the brain, which then can figure out, think, logical analysis of what's going on, and perhaps modify what came first. But this system means that we're always reacting to what is inside of our brain that got there quickly. And we're perceiving the world through that filter. And that part of the brain is going to be biased toward threat. It's cautious. And that's the consequence of evolution based on survival. One way of looking at psychotherapy is there's going to be biases and distortions of perception. And psychotherapy, a lot of it is aimed at elucidating those biases and trying to correct them. But it's a basic biological setup. I think the beauty about psychotherapy is that it does capitalize sensibly on how the brain is organized. That's why it works, basically, I think, the bottom line. But you have to appreciate this primitive brain that we all have that interacts first with the environment and characterizes it. And that's the way the brain prefers it. It prefers fast decisions, quick emotional-based decisions, rather than the slow process of analysis, which is a lot more work. It takes more blood glucose consumption, et cetera. This is the task we have of being human and surviving in our environments.
Yeah, a couple of takeaways from that. Mark and I use different clinical jargon to describe the same thing. I talk about a primitive brain or the midbrain or the lizard brain, which is a little core self, right about our midbrain area. Then our cortex, the big head we have on top of that, executive function, frontal lobes. That's what Mark talking about, with the primitive brain being the fast brain, the slow brain being more deliberative, executive function kind of stuff. And I think a good thing to make clear is that we know from research back in the 80s, Bessel van der Kolk and MGH doing OCD studies, we know that talking changes the chemical composition of the brain.
Yeah.
And we know that changing chemicals, medication does that. We also know that physical activity, walking, exercise, that changes that. So there are three different kinds of ways we can get into our brain to change the chemical composition of the compounds.
Probably diet, too.
Yeah. Diet, and also how we do our thinking. So there are a number of different ways to get into the system. It's very adaptable and changeable like that. But as Mark said, the brain kind of doesn't like being slow and deliberative, and most people prefer to make quick decisions without being very deliberative. And when you're in therapy, certain kinds of therapy anyway, if you have to do a lot of thinking, it's hard work. It's like learning math or science, something like that. A lot of people after high school, they say, no, I don't want to, I don't want to use my brain that much anymore, because it really is hard work to think about stuff.
Yeah. And so we've yet to discover how the brain and mind construct consciousness, but the guess is conscious experience emerges through a convergence of sustained attention, working memory, learned behaviors, language, and culture. So the way the brain and the mind construct consciousness is dedicated to adaptation, not accuracy, right? So so this is, comes back to the, we are so sure we're remembering something accurately, and it may not be. And that comes, I guess, back, Mark, to your point of about
memory,
survival.
Yeah, memory is so porous. I mean, that's why, you know, when people tell the stories, there are little differences when they retell a story, because that's what memory, memory works that way. You know, things you remember, things you leave out. And it's not like a photograph.
Exactly. And it's recreated, actually, in the moment that you're asked to recall something. It's recreated. It's not, the other thing about memory is it's not like stored in vesicles or something like that, and you just kind of have to find the right vesicle or the right file.
It's much more dynamic than that.
It's much more dynamic. It's really a networking, connectivity action in the brain, and you have to re-engage the same circuit that was formed when you first experienced what you're trying to remember. Mm-hmm. And you have to light that circuit up, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And that circuit, when you light it up, it's recreated according to the needs of your survival instincts at the moment that you're recalling, not as a accurate videographer.
It's not like a photograph.
Yeah.
But, you know, in fairness, even if it was a photograph, which is not, our verbal communication skills sometimes vary. So even if I were to repeat, you know, describing a picture to you, I might use a different vocabulary word, you know, even describing the same kind of thing. So it's nothing, it's not like hitting the replay or something. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get that.
That's right.
So these, the FAST systems first develop in childhood, right?
Yeah.
So they learn, remember, so they influence how our brains and our minds construct conscious experience for the rest of our lives. So do we all have those FAST systems learning the same way, or is it different depending on our experiences, our parents?
Capitalizing on what we've talked about so far, we have our five senses, and all our information and learning goes into all our, we talk about two different brains. It's really one central nervous system. We sort of break it down artificially. And it's informed by our five senses. So if you have a sensory integration problem, if you have a learning disability, you're going to have even more of a complicated kind of information processing, fluidity or lack of fluidity, or what we call fluid intelligence or a crystallized intelligence. You're going to have some glitches and be able to encode the information that the environment is feeding you. If you have ADHD, depression, anxiety, PTSD, those are different kind. You can look at them as different kind of filters, filtering the sensory inputs you're getting. So the answer, short answer is no, not everyone processes the information identically. Even those who process the information pretty similarly, there are differences to that.
Okay. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We have psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychologist Michael Abbruzzese with us this morning. We're talking about psychotherapy. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you have an experience or a question that you'd like to share with us, 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we're talking about these FAST systems developing early and what that means later in life.
Right. We talked about the FAST system coming earlier in evolution, but that is replicated in the development of an individual. So a human is formed when a sperm and an egg get together, two cells form one, and then it goes from there. It's obviously miraculous. The FAST system is actually intact and functioning to a large degree in gestation. In the eighth month of gestation, the amygdala, which is a central part of this reptilian or lizard brain that you're referring to, is functioning, is formed and is functioning. So that means that an infant on birth can experience threat, and the body reacts to that threat with agitation. For instance, a baby's born agitated, crying. Mm-hmm. That is essentially directed by the amygdala, because there's been so much physical threat during the process of birth. So the amygdala is there, and it's reacting to threat before there's anything relating to consciousness, to language, to controlled movement, etc. We all know that we walk. We learn to walk. We learn to talk. We learn to feed ourselves before we learn to speak. And speech is necessary for conscious thought because that's how we do it. We do it with words in our heads. So the amygdala more or less is in charge for the first sort of year and a half of our life. And it is still processing information and reactive, very reactive to the environment, such that it really does set the tone for how information is processed for the rest of the life. Because remember, the reptilian brain processes things first and characterizes it, whether it's good for survival or not good for survival, whether it should be approached or avoided.
Yeah, so you said something that is, you talked about consciousness and that we have speech and that then consciousness. But it, doesn't consciousness actually happen before that? Because I'm thinking of kids, when you teach kids sign language, they don't speak yet, but they can, you know, like the word for more or, you know.
I would disagree with some of the hypothesis that Mark is saying. And I think that you can have consciousness without language ability.
Yeah.
We certainly know expressive language comes after receptive language. So little kids understand, you know, what's going on before they can actually repeat what's going on there.
Right, that's true.
It's just a complex
A switch that turns on. It's a
complex
gradual
interplay.
Thing.
Yeah. All right,
let's talk to Susan, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Susan.
Good morning. I just was fascinated by the fast and slow operation of the brain, and I wondered how, with so many of the police shootings, that if and maybe how this would apply to training for people who are might be reacting quickly to a threat to their survival.
Yeah, absolutely, excellent point.
I wonder if you could what might be included in training.
Right.
Thank you.
Susan, thanks for that. That's exactly a
good point. That when any police officer or army combat person is trained, fireman is trained, what they are trained to do is rely on their fast system according to protocols. And so that they get in the groove and what they're doing, they're not really thinking about it. Because if they think about it too much, they can't act quickly and do what's necessary. So training is for the fast system. But the trouble is, there has to be some logic interjected because the police have such a tough job of deciding in a split second whether there's danger or not and how to react to that danger. It's really probably is an impossible job to get it right every time. So when they're trained, they really are talking about training their fast system actually through the conscious learning process. Because there is connection downward from the conscious learning
let me
to the
introduce the concept of voluntary and involuntary, because maybe fast and slow is sometimes confusing. Basically, what all training is, whether it's police, military, martial arts, EMT, fire guys, basically your training is to do what is counterintuitive. You know, we run away from fire, we train fire guys to go in.
Right.
You know, we run away from danger, we train police to, you know, confront the danger and try and deal with that. So we really have to disarm what Mark is talking about, our inborn intuitive kind of stuff. We have to train ourselves below our level of consciousness, the involuntary system, to react just that quickly without doing a lot of thinking in there.
Right.
You know, and it's really to someone's credit when they're trained to you know, do something by the book, whatever that book says, and they stop for a second and say, "Well, I don't think that's the right thing to do," because they have a little, you know, a second thought, which is helpful. And that comes only by experience. So basically, all the folks that we have. Folks in the ER, you know, surgeons, if something happens in a surgery, people are trained to go against what they normally would do, which is to back off and to try and retreat from the threat.
Sure.
And that's a very tricky thing to do. And a lot of people in all those professions are not trained very well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I think we've never really talked about or read about what happens when some of these police departments, when the shootings happen, we don't know what kind of training they went through. Did they go through a lot of training? Not very much training. Was there a lot of nepotism involved in people who are, we don't know what the training is. So,
well, and if you'll hear, the police departments are saying they need more training.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we're hearing.
Right. I would, you know, I could be wrong about this, but my guess is that we have not had any of those incidents on Cape Cod. And I would think that the training that our guys receive here in the Cape probably is very superior to some of the training they get in some other places, right? Because I haven't heard anything about any police shootings on Cape Cod.
Well, we did have that recent shooting.
Quite
except
with the officer had the line of duty death.
Yeah.
So it really depends a lot on the training. That's why it's so important to have a lot of human resource, a lot of repetition, you know, when people have any kind of training, why do you train for emergencies when there's no emergency? So you train yourself to operate the way you're supposed to be when there's emergency. You can't wait until you need that emergency response and then to practice it, because then, like Mark said, your brain is definitely saying, what am I supposed to do next?
Right.
I got to, what
What's
is that
step
on
two?
Page 13?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
You can't, it has to be automatized behavior real quick, which goes into your, what Mark is talking about, the FAST system, what I call the involuntary autonomic nervous system.
We have an email from Gary in Falmouth who says, who has some suggestions about working with therapists. He says, you can shop for a therapist you are comfortable with. Be ready to be honest with your therapist, drinking, drug use, affairs, etc. And this is, have psych meds prescribed by a psychologist, not just a PCP.
You have psych meds prescribed by a psychologist?
Yeah, I don't think that,
can't
that's
be,
it, yeah.
Well, you're out of work, Mark. I'm going to take over. It's really a psychiatrist,
psychiatrist
or a PCP.
Yeah, psychiatrist, it means. But there is a model of psychotherapy that does work a lot of times, is for somebody to be in psychotherapy with a psychologist. Uh-huh. The psychologist does know a fair amount about medication, and he can communicate his opinions to the primary care doctor, who has the license to write the scripts.
Yeah,
it's always fair if you have any knowledge base to make recommendations and talk to the PCP, the psychiatrist. Sometimes they don't want to hear what you have to say, but you can make a recommendation.
So to Gary's point about shopping around for a therapist you're comfortable with, that goes back to Mark, what you were saying about relationships.
Yeah. The drawback, and I'm sorry to interrupt, the drawback is that because of insurance, if someone has XYZ insurance and, a therapist, you have a good relationship, seems to have ABC insurance, that's a real problem. In a perfect world, you'd be able to do, 5 or 6 interviews with people and the insurance would pay for it, and you could choose from between that. But, a lot of times, you have to call the 800 number in the back of your car to see who takes your insurance, because now we have so many cockamamie insurances who refuse to have a therapist on their panel. That is the red herring in the whole thing.
All right, so let me rephrase the question. You are seeing a therapist. How do you know if it's working? What should you be looking for when you go in and see that therapist, whatever your issue is? How long do you give it? And what should that relationship be?
That's a complicated question to answer. Sometimes the work that you're doing can make the individual feel very uncomfortable just by the simple asking of questions. Mm-hmm. And somebody may decide to flee therapy. They're not ready to deal with that. So that could happen after 1 or 2 sessions or 4 or 5 sessions. Other times you may think that you're very comfortable with the therapist because the therapist is not asking you any difficult questions. Mm-hmm. And you figure, hey, I can coast to this. I don't have to talk about anything. I can just bamboozle the therapist. So it's a very complex interplay. But people who want to get some help, they'll be able to understand if they're getting any help, if they notice any change, or if the people around them notice any change, or if the therapist says, I see that, you're presenting differently today, and the therapist should give you some feedback, because quite often the people that you were close to may not see it as quickly as a therapist would if they're paying attention. So it's a complex interplay, but I would think after 3, 4, 5 sessions should be enough. When people come in to see me, I try and give them a dose of what's going to happen in the very first session, so they have a sense of what they're getting into. Do you have
I would echo that. I think you'll know whether it's useful as to how much change there has been in the presenting problem that you came in for, what made you come in for. And if there's not much change and all you're doing is, shooting the breeze, and it's not being, you're not being called on for it or asked to examine why you're veering away from whatever brought you to the door in the first place, then that's a signal for it's not useful. You might be doing you might be showing up and deluding yourself, which people do. And really, again, that's that, it's called the implicit memory. The needs of the amygdala are contrary to the needs necessarily of psychological growth, because the amygdala is always protecting, and anything that it's sending up signals that are in the interest of protecting. And one of the main ways is it protects the sense of self, which is a conscious, luckily a conscious function. The way it protects it is by creating false scenarios, fake scenarios.
Well, before people get too scared by that, that's really a psychoanalytically oriented theory, which as a behaviorist I don't I don't agree with. Mm-hmm. You could conceptualize like that.
Well,
certainly.
I don't know if you don't agree with it because you use behavior cognitive techniques to undo that. You're just not looking at the kind of the origins of it, but you're going right for the meat, so
well,
to speak.
Right. No, I'm just thinking there are different origins of that. I think it really mm-hmm. reduces down to a very simple, not quite Pavlovian response. There's an intervening variable. It's basically stimulus intervening variable and a response. And I think that we are trained, where Freud talked about id, ego, and superego, and we have, you know, brain structure. We can sort of fit into that heuristic. It's a lot simpler. You want to keep it as simple as you can. Basically, we've learned a lot of our bad habits, and it's enormously difficult to change a bad habit and develop a new habit.
Yep.
But it basically the so-called mathematical algorithm by which you do that is pretty simple,
mm-hmm.
which is why, you know, when Mark and I talk about getting a good therapist, they have to know, you know, if you have a conceptualization as Mark did, then your therapist has to know in their own mind how to get through those mm-hmm. defenses, you know, a psychoanalytic term. As a behaviorist, you have to think about, you know, how to break that connection between the stimulus response. So the approach
right.
is still the same, but the
yep.
jargon is a little bit different.
That's right. Yeah.
But
yeah.
I don't want people to be hearing what Mark's saying and think, oh my God, this is so complicated. How is someone ever going to get through that?
Yeah.
We're just using different terms to That's talk right. about right. the process. About
Absolutely.
That. Don't be too scared about the terms.
Yeah. No, these yeah. things meld.
Yeah. And also, something you said earlier, you know, there's sort of this stigma. I can still remember I had one of my brothers had some difficulty in his teenage years, and I suggested to my father that he see a psychologist. And my father said, he's not crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you only go see people like when you're crazy.
When you're mental.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I never could get him to do it because that was his image of why you would go see a psychologist.
Yeah, well, I think that's
or
changed in the
yeah.
in
I
current
hope so.
Generations.
Yeah.
I think it has. Back, you know, when we were younger, certainly it was like that. And I think it's generations, the millennials and their kids, I think it's changing a little bit. Now there's so much talk about depression and ADHD mm-hmm. and anxiety. It's certainly becoming, you know, much more out in the open to talk about it. Nowadays, people say they're depressed when they're not depressed. Oh, I'm so depressed. Oh, everyone I know is depressed. You know,
yeah.
Especially teenagers. You know, I'm so depressed. So, again, yeah. you want to check in with someone because it might not be depression. It could be something else.
Yeah, and anxiety. I mean,
anxiety
is huge. And even in children, you mm-hmm. wouldn't think, what does a kid have to be anxious about? But they have anxiety
well,
as well.
What they have to be anxious about is
a lot, really.
Is in their, yeah. Is in there what we call the implicit memory, the unconscious memory, and that has to do with existence and safety. And just getting back to what we were talking about earlier about the first kind of years of life, that's where that basic sense of safety
is
formed.
That's what I'm disagreeing with. I don't
okay.
think that's where it's caused. You know, so I just want people to know there's another hypothesis out there.
Which is?
Well, I think it's basically a stimulus response. You know, there's no such thing as anxiety. We give ourselves anxiety. Just like, you know, Mark and I got to talk about something further on about suffering versus pain.
Yeah.
Well, pain is caused by the environment,
right.
but suffering we just kind of do to ourselves. It's a psychological right. imposition upon ourselves, and we can, you know, kind of turn that on or turn that off. The same thing with anxiety. You know, a lot of people don't know what they're experiencing. It's a sense, I will use term, a broad term like upset or unease
discomfort.
Or dis-ease, mm-hmm. which some people call anxiety mm-hmm. or nervousness. I differentiate nervousness and anxiety and upset to make it easier for people to talk about stuff.
So explain that. What is the difference?
Well, I define what most people call anxiety, I call nervousness. Nervousness is you are worried about something, but you can identify what it is. I'm not going to do well on this test. My teacher's mm-hmm. going to yell at me. My parents get mad at me. I'm not doing it. I'm still going to get in trouble, you know, but I can identify it. And anxiety, which comes close to what Mark is talking about, a fearful threat, you still have that unease, but you can't put your finger. You don't know what
mm-hmm.
it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what leads to, there's something wrong. I don't know what it is. It makes you kind of skittish, kind of nervous about
mm-hmm.
that. And the difference is you can't identify it. So when you can't identify what's causing the nervousness, that makes people crazy. That mm-hmm. makes them really worried.
Sure.
And that is what I define as an anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And that can develop into an anxiety, a generalized anxiety disorder, separation, something like that. But it's different from nervousness. Most
mm-hmm.
people are just nervous, but they're mislabeling it as anxious.
Mm-hmm.
And like sometimes people mislabel sadness as depression. It's a different kind
yeah.
of thing mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
So a little bit of a different take. And
yeah.
I think that we condition ourselves. Basically, the lecture I give is we have sensory inputs that go into our primitive brain, which has the amygdala and the hippocampus and the limbic system right up there. And the hippocampus, you know, thinks, well, have I seen this before? Do I know what this is?
Yeah.
I don't know. So, hey, amygdala, what do you think we should do about this? Should we run? Mm-hmm. You know, should we play dead? Should we, you know, fight? What should we do? And the amygdala says, Yeah, I don't really know. I haven't seen this. Let me kick it upstairs to the frontal lobes. Hey, guys, what do you think this is over here? And the frontal lobes really come up with the labeling. Okay, so when you're like a little kid, well, how do you label anxiety? You don't label anxiety.
Don't know
it just
is,
becomes,
yeah.
as Mark talked about, below your level of language or linguistic ability. It is just a felt experience. And over time, you just somehow pick up the idea that, oh, it must be anxiety. When in reality, you're not having an anxious reaction. It's really a full-blown panic attack. Mm-hmm. But until someone gives you that label, you don't know what it is, and sometimes they mislabel. So to me, it's a question of, we've talked about this before, you know, Vygotsky's, you know, psychoanalytic talk about linguistic issues for being part of psychotherapy and part of psychopathology. So it really, I think, is a conditioned response with language, which is similar to what Mark is talking about, but I think it's maybe a little bit easier to understand.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that or modify is that the amygdala, it doesn't deliberate. The amygdala just reacts. It's fast, and it's biased toward threat, so that the signal goes into the body, actually, to react as if there's threat.
Right, comes from the body and goes back in the body.
Right, and then the conscious brain gets aware, oh, my body's changed, my heart is racing, I'm sweaty, I'm jumpy, I'm jiggy.
And then it labels
then
that.
The interpretation goes on. But it's the that amygdala that filters so much first and labels it as threat. And that's why, again, the first few years are so important because that's when the amygdala is active without any restraint. And it's only later on that there's some restraint on the amygdala. And the amygdala doesn't forget. It doesn't you can't remember what went in there, it doesn't forget
let's
it.
Let's talk about that.
We're over our break. So 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll pick it up after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about psychotherapy with psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychologist Michael Abbruzzese. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation, 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And before the break, we were talking about below-level awareness. Who wants to pick it up?
Right. So just to capitalize on what Mark was saying, when he used the term memory, you know, when we're so young, the first 18 months, 2 years, we don't have any language capability, but we do have the ability to experience whatever thing or upset we're feeling, and that goes in our body.
Right.
And the old cognitive therapists used to call that a motor memory or a body memory. Somatic memory. You don't have any cognitions about that. So something happens, a traumatic experience happens when you're 18 months old. That's in your body. It stays there. You have no vocabulary to describe it. So 10, 15, 20 years, 40 years later, you're in therapy. You don't have language to describe what happened, but it's in there someplace. So it's a kind of memory, but you don't have cognitive vocabularial access to it.
And the important thing is that memory biases so much of experience subsequently. So much of the internal dialogue that a person has is actually based on that memory. Supposedly it's the right side of the brain that has a kind of a contribution to the internal dialogue that's pretty consistently negative. The evolutionary theory of that is that it serves to keep the person in the group, in the tribe, which is survival. If there's a kind of a negative policeman always speaking, so to speak, to the decision maker, don't do this, don't do that, so you can stay in the group.
Right. Caitlin is giving us a call from Edgartown. Good morning, Caitlin.
Hi.
Yep, go ahead.
I'm just interested in this conversation very much, and I just feel a little bit like both guests have so many good things to say, and I do feel a little bit like Mark is getting cut off in what he's saying. And so I'm not I don't feel afraid. I go to therapy and I don't have any fear about what Mark is saying. And I'm just interested to hear what he has to say without interruption.
Okay. Oh, my goodness.
Okay. Well, I think he's getting his two cents in. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah. Well, I don't know where you wanted to pick it up, but the basic concept is that we're so biased from early experiences. And early experiences have mainly to do with attachment, because attachment to the early caregivers is what sets the stage for security a sense of security in the rest of your life. And so much of it determines self-esteem. So much of it determines intelligence, because if you're not secure, you don't learn very well, and you don't develop what intellectual capacities you might have, because anxiety cuts off learning and thinking. That's why it's so important, at least the way I look at psychotherapy, for there to be a safe therapeutic alliance, a safe therapeutic alliance in which it has been talked about as having a good enough mothering experience. And there has to be an aspect of that in the psychotherapy relationship to really be working, even with behavior therapists, I believe, because that's what will really facilitate the swallowing of the ideas that behavior therapy, presents, because as I said before, behavior therapy is going right to the root of the issue, right to the root of the problem, directly, without kind of going through the development of the self, which the psychoanalytic approach does, which is much longer and more arduous. So if you're if you have a specific problem, behavior therapy is the thing to do. But it's hard. It involves homework, repetition. Training is basically what we're talking about. Training that FAST system to be more in concordance with what your goals are in life, as opposed to just physical survival.
No, I'm not saying anything. No.
All right, then we go to Whitney's email, who says, please talk about the subject matter of Michael Pollan's new book, incorporating the huge class of previously banned substances in combination with therapy to treat various conditions, including PTSD, addiction, depression, fear of death, etc.
Yeah, this has to do with the return to our present social consciousness and medical consciousness of psychedelics. Because Michael Pollan's book is about the history of the psychedelics and their application that can be quite useful now. And basically, the concept, as I understand it on the surface, is being able to change one's mind, change how you perceive things through a psychedelic experience or two. I think what he describes is how it can be used in therapy now. Talk therapy is part of it. There's safety established between therapist and patient. Then they take a psychedelic, have a trip over 5 or 6 hours with the therapist present as a guide. Again, there has to be basics safety established. And the therapist is sort of whispering to the amygdala, if you will, try to perceive this traumatic event or events a little bit differently here. And supposedly the psychedelic state is a little bit more accepting of this kind of learning experience. And I think that's the thesis behind what might be useful from psychedelics.
Yeah, my perspective is that that is all not so necessary.
Maybe not.
Maybe helpful. Yep. And some people, certainly in America, people prefer to have a pill to do something than just something else. But we could do the same thing with hypnosis and EMDR. But not everyone wants to go through hypnosis or EMDR, and they'd rather take a pill. So not everyone wants to go through yoga. They want to do walking or jumping. So
it can be very useful in the terminally ill.
It could be
because you don't
helpful.
Have time to do other things.
No. The question is, how helpful can this be for people? And there are different, that they say, different strokes for different folks.
Oh, sure.
That could be a very helpful adjunctive to other people who need it.
That's right.
So
right.
Another area to look into.
All right. So we didn't mention shame. Core shame. What is core shame?
Yeah. Well, shame is a useful emotion that evolution has come up with to keep us in line and keep our tribe together and to keep us cooperating. So that's why we have, the hardware to experience shame. And then, of course, it gets programmed by experience. But core shame is a more deep experience of it. And this really comes from the problems in early attachment, where there's a misattunement or there's a mismatch between the baby's needs and what the mother is experiencing. For instance, a big example would be a mother with postpartum depression. postpartum depression means that the mother really can't relate very affectively and effectively with the infant. They're withdrawn, they're cold, they're even angry. So there's a misentombment. Well, the amygdala translates that as I'm bad, I'm unlovable. And that stays. That sense of oneself stays, even though logically it doesn't make sense. These people very frequently become people pleasers and super caregivers, but they still have that sense, I'm unlovable. And it's because in the early experience of their life, their brain was programmed to be biased in this direction. And the direction that we label it as is a sense of inner shame about being unworthy, unlovable, not good enough for the tribe, not good enough for being cared about. And of course, when you have that kind of sense of yourself, you're going to have trouble in life, especially in relationships.
So is this, I mean, whatever the bias is, if we're talking about a lot of bias here in your brain, can these things be, they can be undone, right?
That's the good news.
Right, that's the good news, is that right. With psychotherapy, you can fix these
absolutely
problems.
Yeah, our brain also has the capacity to observe. In spite of everything that's kind of coming up from the implicit memory or the amygdala, mm-hmm. you know, the reptilian brain, we still have the conscious capacity to observe. And that's what the therapist wants to engage as a team in the self-observing. And the behavior therapist will come at it by observe or label these dysfunctional ideas and inner talk as disruptive and unrealistic. When you have that, stop it. Halt is one of the terms that's used. Halt and observe yourself as to what you're feeling and see if there's other ways consciously of interpreting these events. Because don't forget, the memories that are formed early on are not contextual, meaning that they don't have any time sense attached to them. When we have conscious memories, we know when events occurred and when they didn't. So that's contextualized. But these traumatic memories, these rejection memories, these abandonment memories, they're not contextualized. They're not associated with time. So when you experience it, it's like a flashback. Mm. That you relive it, but it's what's triggered it is some perhaps minor interaction in the present.
Your thoughts on? We got a minute left. So
yeah, the difference is in the approach is that the work that I do as a cognitive behavioral therapist, I'm not focusing on the why. You know, Mark talks about a lot of the why,
right.
And many people find that very interesting, and it
sure.
sort of makes good stories and good movie lines. But in behavioral therapy, you don't focus on the why because sometimes those are unanswerable. So mm-hmm. something must have happened when I was very young. Well, maybe. The question is how. How do I get to where I want to be? How do I untangle whatever happened? So
exactly.
How, I think, is more important than why, at least from the behavioral perspective, not from the analytic
right.
perspective.
Right.
So.
Yeah, some people want to know why and some people don't care
and
why. They
correct.
Just want to be able to change
yeah.
the behavior.
The only reason to know why is so you can change.
Mm-hmm.
That's the bottom line.
All right. So final quick thought on folks who want to seek out something.
Just yeah, ask Mark to talk about consciousness. Do we have time for 30 seconds?
We have 15 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay.
What about consciousness?
The development of consciousness, I wanted to just mention the origin of consciousness and the breakdown of the bicameral mind by Julian James. I know Mark had something he wanted to talk about. We didn't get to it.
Yeah.
So
well,
I'll put that book out there if anybody wants to see about consciousness.
We'll put that on To Be Continued.
Okay.
Right. Psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychologist Michael Albizzese. See you next month. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.